Greetings, everyone, and we are back with episode 2 of our podcast series entitled Celebrating Black Women in Leadership and Decision-Making Spaces in commemoration of the 2023 United Nations International Day for People of African Descent. My name is London, and I am joined by my esteemed colleagues and fellow founding members of the Global Black Collective Institute, Ikram Warsame and Brenda Smith-Lezama. As 2020 United Nations African Descent Fellows, we are excited to collaborate with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to bring you this series to amplify the 2023 theme for the International Day for People of African Descent, honoring the contributions of the African diaspora. For our second episode, Ikram, Brenda, and I have a compelling and inspiring conversation with Dr. Barbara G. Reynolds, Chair of the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. Listen in as Dr. Reynolds shares about the important work of the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent and her dedication and journey to promoting justice, inclusion, and equality. Be sure to check out our show notes for Dr. Reynolds' bio and the website link to the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. Now let's get into our conversation. Thank you, Barbara, for joining us today, and want to welcome our co-host, Ikram and Brenda. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
So, Barbara, I want to ask you, could you provide us with insights into the importance of the International Day for People of African Descent and discuss how your current role as the chair of the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent aligns with the celebration of this significant day?
This particular day is important in one sense only. It's a day we can galvanize global attention, regional attention, national attention, community attention, to the issues, the progress, the challenges of people of African descent, Black peoples, people in the diaspora, but also people who are born outside of the continent. I usually say that this day is not for Black people because I have 365 days of people of African descent, and every 4 years I have 366 days. So it's really an opportunity for us to advocate, to share, to draw attention. This is a world where there's so many days alone, but so many competing contemporary issues. You just want people to pause for just one day and say, hey, have a look at this. Are we on the right track? Are we facing the right direction? What else can you do? What can I, as a person of African descent or as a Black person, help you do to advance our agenda with the understanding that when people of African descent or Black people progress, the whole world benefits. It's not just for us, it's for humanity. Now, the working group has taken a step to commemorate this day, to celebrate it as much as possible. And for the very same reason, this year we had a forum of first-person testimonies of people of African descent fleeing the Ukraine conflict. Not many people can even imagine that there are people of African descent in that situation. But when you hear their stories, and what was important to me and what was significant and a little bit difficult, I'll confess, is there was a short video clip. And the visual image is so powerful. I mean, I was there with this young man, about 20-something. You know, he's a student. He was a student pleading, saying, you've taken my papers. How can I prove my identity if you've taken my papers? And I think what the working group is able to do is to help, first of all, amplify the voices of people who are not being heard. Second, to increase the visibility of people who are invisible to the rest of the world. And third, to reach people who those very people cannot reach. That's why we do what we do.
I saw some of the pictures of people who were fleeing the conflict, who were people of African descent, on the news. And to be quite honest, it was shocking to see the treatment, even in the context of people, all human beings fleeing a war zone, how Black people are being targeted. It was so shocking and disappointing to see the reaction of many other outside African people of African descent, many of other people, how they reacted, and the lack of sensitivities to where the victims, people of African descent who were victims in that context. Just on that context, how do you see, given your role as a chair of the working group, how do you see the influence, how Black women in leadership position can advance the right of people of African descent?
Ikram, this is one of those split-screen situations, emotionally, but strategically. So on the one screen, we know that women have traditionally been behind in terms of visibility in leadership positions, in terms of things like equal pay, in terms of the triple burden that they bear in the home. And we understand that. As a person of African descent, we understand that women of African descent are subject to subpar healthcare because people assume that we're stronger or our pain threshold is higher or any number of things that are not really real. That's one part of the screen. But as a female, as a mom, as a sister, as a professional, I'm equally seized by the fact that Black men and boys, that men of African descent and boys of African descent are at high risk. And the risk is growing every day through the school to prison pipeline, through the underemployment, through the unemployment. And most of those times, it's because the education hasn't really prepared them for the world of work. Through the influence of peers who are just as frustrated that they are, and therefore they resort to gangs and they resort to illicit activities. So, yes, we needed to do some work for women, leadership, visibility, equal pay, proper health, housing for women who head households, for women who are intergenerational in terms of keeping older persons alive and rearing younger persons. Yes, we need to do that. But at the same time, 50% of our population needs equal care and attention. It's just different. How do we protect our men and boys? And all of you have been in pretty sophisticated urban development areas. And you know, when your son or your brother goes on the highway to drive for 4 hours, you are just praying that he is not stopped by somebody on the road and ask for, "Can I see you?" and makes the wrong move. And the next thing you know, he is a statistic on the TV. And so this split screen is important. And we need, I think, to invest, but we need to understand that they're different strategies. And then the third part of that triangle I'm going to say is that we then need to figure out how to integrate our strategies. Because if we look at domestic violence, for example, affecting women up and down the globe, a lot of times the perpetrators are our own men and boys. Not all the time, not in war, certainly. But some of the time. So, even in addressing problems of women and girls, we've got to get the engagement of men and boys. And so, I think this triangular approach is so essential. And I continue to advocate for that as a feminist, even though I'm not a big academic feminist, but I'm certainly a female. And I think it's important as a gender specialist, as an advocate for human rights. Rights. I think we need to look at the entirety and see where our parts fit in. I hope that makes sense.
And
Thank you for that perspective. I think it's interesting to hear your perspective on the equity in that's needed in this movement, right? From the framework of this podcast series, which is celebrating Black women in leadership and decision-making spaces, it's important to not lose that component of equity in fighting for all Black people. Having been involved in such impactful organizations like UNICEF and Save the Children UK, how do you envision these platforms contributing to the acknowledgement of Black women's contributions specifically and challenges in global leadership and advocacy?
So both of those institutions, I'm proud of the work that they do. They're not perfect, but I'm definitely proud of the work that they do. And I was privileged to work with UNICEF for a little over 23 years when you add it all up together, and to work with Save the Children, which is really an outstanding global international NGO, if you consider that this Save in USA and Save in Europe and what have you. In both of those institutions, I think there is a lot that they have done in terms of forging advocacy strategies, outreach strategies, engagement strategies. And in both institutions, children have been at the heart of it. Children and women, but women mostly in an instrumental role, you know, the maternal this, the mother that, the baby feeding, what have you. And I think in both institutions, they've set a mark down about the protection of the human rights of children. And that is elusive. And I think that there's a lot of work that continues to be done more and more for women, including young women, youth, where I think that we as advocates now, as human rights advocates for people of African descent, I think we need to make not just UNICEF or Save the Children, but virtually every international organization, whether it's an intergovernmental organization like the UN, or it's a non-governmental organization like Save the Children, understand that the same strategies you used to promote gender equality are portable to promoting racial equality, because that's the bottom line. There's nothing different about us. I mean, look at us. I always say that people of African descent are neither monochromatic or monolithic. We're sitting here, you can count our identities in terms of nationalities, in terms of age, in terms of who is visually challenged, like I am, or any number of other things. Okay? But what we have in common is that we've claimed our African ancestry or African identity, which makes us, whether we like it or not, subject to racial animus, to racial bigotry. Now, while it is universally acknowledged that, you know, gender equality and identity are things that we espouse, we're not that here. We're not there yet about Black people. But it's the same skills, it's the same human rights. They're indivisible, they're interrelated, they're interdependent. So my Blackness cannot be divorced from my femaleness. I'm both, I'm all two all the time. Okay? And therefore, our work, your work as advocates, has to be to help governments, to help intergovernmental organizations like the UN, to help international NGOs, but also to drill down in your own nationalities, in your own nations, in your own communities, and believe it or not, in our own families, our own churches, mosques, temples, our own clubs, that you cannot promote gender equality and accept racial inequality. Now, if we're able to do that up here, the ideation, the philosophy, then the strategies are out there. We know what to do. I spent a lot of my time doing human rights-based approach to programming for children. So we know the steps. It's the same thing, human rights-based approach to programming for Black people, for Indigenous people, for minorities people, for people with disabilities, for LGBTQI, is the same human being. So they're portable scales. We have to change the mindset of here and help people to understand that you can't be afraid in our 21st century world of calling out racial inequality. It takes courage, but the same way it took courage to do it for gender equality, it's the same courage we need for racial equality. I think that that's part of where we are right now.
I appreciate that perspective so much. And one of the core values of Global Black Collective Institute is approaching anti-Black racism from an intersectional lens. So I really appreciate your insight on that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you for that question, Brenda and Barbara. Thank you for your brilliant answer. And as we continue to celebrate Black women in leadership, as chair of the working group, how do you see the celebration of Black women in leadership aligning with the broader goals of justice and equality emphasized during the International Decade for People of African Descent?
So this decade thing, well, first of all, we have to admit that the decade was really, in some places, 0 years, in other places, 1 year, in other places, 2 years, because a lot of governments did not feed back to their people that there was a decade. And your work about helping the UN to be accessible to the person in the street, real people, is so important on that. Because, I mean, I've done this informal poll. You know, I've asked university lecturers, so what have you done for the international decade? And they say, the what? And they're Black. And I say, you know, the international, haven't heard about it. And so we know that people haven't heard about it. So that's one thing that we're advocating for on the working group, but also the permanent forum, that there must be a second decade. And I say there has to be a second decade, not just to call it a decade, but first, member states have to inform their citizens that there is a decade. That's one. Two, member states have to invest in the decade. Otherwise, why is it a decade? And number three, member states must protect advocates for this year. You can't be saying at the UN that there's a decade, and then in your own country, you're, how shall I say it? You are not happy with individual advocates who are calling out racism, who are calling out inequality. They're not burning tires, they're not looting, they're just using their voice to say, come on, you can do better. So for us to have a second decade, absolutely. The conventions are there, we're working on a declaration, but we do need member states to first of all inform people, but invest in their capacities, invest in their structures. People want to take care of themselves. So if we invest in their capacities and their structures, they will take care of themselves and then protect advocates so that they don't feel that they're under the sword of Damocles simply because they're doing what they want to do. So I think that's one thing that has to be done. The other thing that needs to be done is exactly what you're doing now, speaking from the perspective of, first of all, excuse me, I don't mean to be pejorative and this is not ageism, but you ladies are very young and we need to help empower you because we are literally handing the baton off to you. And if we do that right, when you get to be our age, you can hand the baton off to somebody else. And by then, I hope it's not the same issue, it's something else. Look, we still need to figure out what AI is going, the impact AI is going to have on people generally and people of African descent. Okay, so we need that. But also we need to understand why it is that people of African descent are so economically disadvantaged. And what can we do about it? Okay, so when we put those things together, I think we have a pretty good handle of saying, okay, There was the decade. The recognition, kind of, you know, it's there in law. But if you're not listening to me, and if I can't see myself on the television, see myself in the movies, worse, see myself in the curriculum and have my history be respected, then the job of recognition is only partially done. And then the second element has to be, okay, you recognize us. We need development, but we also need self-development. For me to have self-development, I have to have access to credit. When I go to the bank, they can't look at me and give me a rate that is different from the rate of my sister over here because of the texture of my hair or the color of my skin. So development is a real thing. What kind of housing do I have? What kind of job do I have? What kind of social security do I have? What kind of pension do I have? And that's the definition, that's the development piece, because justice has a cost. And so your advocacy costs you. You're doing it as a volunteer. We still have to live. You got to pay the bills, you got to run your car, pay your Wi-Fi, all kinds of things. So the justice and development, I think, will go hand in hand. But there's still some work on the recognition piece that has to be done, and we have to continue to push all three. Make sense? Good.
That's actually, it's funny that you mentioned that people, not a country, member country, have not only informed their citizens about the decade, but also invest in it. As you know, Canada is the only Western country which adopted the decade. And fortunately, maybe there's some information and mostly done by civil society within Canada to promote the decade, but there's no investment per se from the federal government into the decade to promote programs of activity. But one thing I've noticed, it's, although I'm proud of the fact that Canada is the only Western country that adopted the decade, it's shocking that people are not making that an issue at the UN level, where other Western countries who constantly lecture other countries on issue of human rights, simple decade for people of African descent. I find that like very telling. And to follow up on that, is there, can you share your insight from your experience on strategies and practices that organization can use in order to incorporate Black woman perspective into their practice and policies?
Well, you have to be explicit about it. It's not going to get there by magic. And so the leadership of the organization has to be intentional about saying, how are our policies aligned with advancing Black people, Black women, Black leaders? And if that's our intention, how do we back it up? So there's a straight parallel there with the decade. Okay, exactly what we said. So you have to be intentional about it. And if you're intentional, you've got to invest in it. The word affirmative action has taken on some tones that really are not intentional. And these narratives, they run away with us. I tend to use positive and specific measures. And affirmative action was never to give anybody a pass, as we know. It was where people meet the criteria, where people are eligible, where people are qualified, experienced, that they not be denied because of the color of the skin, which is what was happening. In fact, in many instances, people were more qualified, more experienced, but they were still denied because of the color of the skin. So affirmative action was intended to say, look, let's level the playing field and let's make sure, one, that people are not being denied. And then two, if there was accumulated impact because of historic denial, to reverse that, then there has to be current preference. Otherwise, you can't level the playing field. It's like the old child seesaw. You know, if one side is up all the time, that other side is always going to be a bottom. To get them here, that side has to come down, this side has to go up. I mean, these are basic things. I don't know if that's physics or whatever, but I know it's some kind of science, some kind of logic, some kind of thing that we can all understand. And so that is the second thing. One has to be intentional. Sorry, the first thing is one has to recognize. Second, be intentional. And third, to take specific positive measures to make it happen. It is not going to happen by magic. Okay? And I do repeat that it takes courage. I do repeat that it takes thinking and reflecting and engaging other people. But you know what? I'm going to be very frank about this. A couple of years ago, there was a global financial crisis. And big governments went out and intentionally invested in one part of the world. And we can see the difference today. Okay? After the Second World War, there were a couple of nations in financial crisis, in economic crisis. And a couple of governments got together and intentionally invested in them. And that's where they are. And so if there is a commitment to racial equality, people are going to be intentional in investing in people of African descent and Black peoples. You don't have to do it forever. Okay? All of you are viable. Somebody invested in you, your mom, the community, your scholarship, and now you're viable. You're not continually, you know, spreading out your hands. Now what you have done in turn is to say, okay, people have invested in me and how can I help? And that's the last point I'm going to make on the subject. I am really concerned about people of African descent who have benefited from these specific and positive measures, who then turn around and want to deny that's how they got there, and then remove that scaffolding, remove that platform for people who look like themselves in the mirror. I'm not going to say anything else but that. I just leave that one alone.
Thank you. We can all echo your comments on what it means or what it takes to be a leader, specifically that leadership has to be intentional and everything that comes with that. Given your extensive experience, what advice would you offer to young Black women who are aspiring to that type of leadership, to that type of ethical leadership, specifically in leadership roles in human rights, advocacy, and education?
I'm going to be honest. So you know the education thing, correct?
Yeah.
We're all doing that. And you know the reaching out to influential people, you know that. But there's some other hard work that we have to do. So when I started at UNICEF, nobody knew me. That's the way it should be. Oh, but I learned. I had some fabulous supervisors. And one of the things that I used to do was volunteer for work. Okay? I'm going to give you a good example, Ikram, because one of my bosses shares Indigenous ancestry with you. And I was probably early mid-career, and he was asking for volunteers to take notes at a meeting. And if I'm not mistaken, I probably by that time had my doctorate. Probably, I can't remember. And so I was like, I will. And then some colleagues asked me, excuse me, why are you doing that? I'm saying, because I'll learn. Because when I take notes, I get access to information that I wouldn't have. I won't be in that room. Well, how else would I get in that room? I'd be a mosquito to get in that room. I'm making a very important point here. It's about humility. It's about being willing to climb the ladder legitimately. It's about putting in the hard work at the bottom and paying honor to those who have gone before. I recognize that the reason why I'm here is because you had maybe a smaller group of persons than now knocking at doors. You go back 100 years, you go back 200 years, those people gave their all. So we're not the first person advocating for anything. For women, human rights, people of African descent, people have been doing. So we honor them and we prepare to put in the hard work. And hard work means volunteering. Don't get paid for it. But doing it with passion and doing it with excellence. And doing it like if it is a real job. And then two more things. You need to have fun. You can't go through life without fun. And fun, it comes in different colors and shapes and expressions. You know, some of us will go to museums, some of us will fly a kite. Some of us will go have a beer. Some of us will go to the beach and just to zone out. You have to have fun. Keep that fun in your life, that liberating experience. And then probably the last thing I would say for that is never forget from where you came. Turn around, look back, whether it's family, it's friends, your high school, your primary school, your village, your godmother, your godfather, your foster mother, your foster father. It don't matter whomever helped you to get where you are now. I think we need to turn back, not just to say thanks, but to invest. So we're paying it forward, but also we're paying it backwards. I hope that makes sense because that's what's worked for me. And, you know, I can share that.
Oh, yes. I really appreciate all of those pearls of wisdom that you just dropped for us. And I just feel like everything that you have just said about humility, you know, and having fun and that volunteer piece, you know, and building yourself up is something that I know that I have done in my own career and story. And I know Brenda and Ikram, you've also done. So thank you for just putting it out there. With that, could you reflect on some of the challenges you've encountered throughout your career and your journey as the chair of the working group of experts for people of African descent, and share how these experiences have shaped your dedication to promoting justice, inclusion, and equality?
I think I'll shape them in lessons learned, if you don't mind. Our allies come in all shapes, sizes, forms, colors, socioeconomic status. There is no race that's outside of our alliances. There's no gender outside of our alliances. There's no nationality, socioeconomic status. Allies are true gold. And I have learned to look for them and cherish them and nurture that. So they're there. Now, the flip side of that is painful. So let me just put it out there. Not all skin folk are kinfolk. And surprisingly, a sister will pull you down. A brother will stab you in the back. Another sister will spit on you. Another brother will criticize you or tell lies. Bob Marley said it well. No need to go there. So I think that's one thing. The second thing I think is being able to speak in multiple literacies. Let me explain. I'm not saying multiple languages. I'm saying multiple literacies. So the conversation you have at home with your peeps from Detroit is English, but it's not the conversation you'll have elsewhere. That's one literacy. There's another literacy And sometimes we're not prepared to switch from one literacy to the next. And you know, a lot of the training and orientation that we give to young people in going for a job is make the switch. Okay, so when you go into a job interview, that's not your homie. It's English or French or Spanish or Swahili or whatever. But within that language, it's a different literacy. So do make the switch. And I think we don't do that enough. And therefore, sometimes we come off as not what we intended to be. And you can interpret that any which way you want. And I think the last thing about that, in terms of the lessons that I've learned, is all of that is strategic and tactical. But what's on the inside has to be authentic. It has to be consistent. It has to be true. At the end of the day, I have to live with me. And when everything is over, when the party is over, even if I'm in a house with 10 people, I still have to make peace with me before I go to sleep. You know what I mean? And so it's about, I mean, today we have some really good terms about it, like self-care and mental hygiene and a lot of other things, you know? But I want to emphasize it's the finding that internal grounding. Whatever it is, so that what I say is authentic. So what I say synchronizes with what I truly believe and what I want to do. Those are the lessons that I've learned. And I think, you know, that's what I apply, but I apply them in my day job as well as my volunteer work. So it works for me.
Well, Dr. Barbara Reynolds, on behalf of the Global Black Collective Institute and Bell Global Justice Institute, we would all like to thank you so much for your time, for your wisdom, for all of the work that you do on behalf of people of African descent around the world and advancing human rights. And we just want to thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. I do look forward to meeting you guys.
Thank you so much to Dr. Reynolds, Ikram, and Brenda for such a wonderful conversation today. These are the kinds of experiences that make my heart full. Today's conversation makes me think of one of my favorite quotes by Mother Harriet Tubman. And this quote helps to light the way and shape my journey as a human rights advocate. And Mother Harriet says, "Every great dream begins with a dreamer. Always remember, you have within you the strength, the patience, and the passion to reach for the stars to change the world." And I hope that our episode and Mother Harriet's quote resonates with all of you.